Welcome to Return to the Source on WJAB from the campus of Alabama A&M University, 90.9.
Listening to Return to the Source here at 90.9 FM WJAB. Of course, this is the music of trumpeter Eddie Henderson from his latest recording on Smoke Sessions Records called Be Cool. He's playing the Herbie Hancock composition, one called Toys. And we started out the set with another selection from his CD, Be Cool, the Woody Shaw composition, The Moon Train. Featured Eddie with Donald Harrison on the alto sax, Kenny Barron on piano, Isiat on bass, and Mike Clark on the drums. And of course, as we said before, Eddie Henderson is one of my favorite musicians. In fact, born in New York City, and he has been one of the outstanding trumpeters in jazz for at least the last 30 years or so. As a teenager, he moved with his family to San Francisco, where he studied trumpet, flugelhorn, and music theory at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And after serving in the Air Force, he enrolled at UC Berkeley, where he graduated with a degree in zoology in 1964. He then went on to study medicine at Howard University, graduating in 1968 and doing his residency in psychiatry. And while practicing general medicine, he performed occasionally with musicians like John Handy, Joe Henderson, Big Black, and Philly Joe Jones. His first major music exposure came during the period between 1970 and 1973 as a member of Herbie Hancock's sextet, the group called Mwadishi. Of course, he appeared on several classic recordings by that group. He also made his first two recordings as a leader during this period. And after leaving Herbie, he went on to work with people like Pharoah Sanders, the Jazz Messengers, Norman Connors, and the Latin jazz group Azteca. And of course, he also would lead his own bands, and he made several albums for Blue Note Records. He remained active as a leader and sideman throughout the 80s, eventually moving back to New York, in the process becoming one of the leading trumpeters in straight ahead jazz. In fact, he led his own recordings and appeared and recorded with people like Billy Harper, Kenny Barron, Mulgrew Miller, McCoy Tyner, Grover Washington Jr., and Benny Golson, just to name a few. Eddie Henderson is also a member of the all-star ensemble, The Cookers. In fact, he's been a member since its inception. He's also been involved in jazz education at institutions like Juilliard and Oberlin, and his most recent recordings are on Smoke Sessions Records, including his latest, as I mentioned before, the album called Be Cool. We'll talk about all that and much more. And Eddie, welcome to WJAB and Return to the Source.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right.
To be on the program.
All right. In fact, I should have introduced you as Dr. Eddie Henderson. I apologize for that. But as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, man, you know, I actually interviewed you here back in, 1995, 23 years ago.
I must be having a senior moment.
but you know what is interesting, Eddie? We actually, it's actually almost 23 years to the day. In fact, when I interviewed you back in 1995, it was December 10th, and now it's December 12th.
Damn.
All right, so it was supposed to happen, man. But anyway, let's begin with your family background, Eddie. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think our audience would find this very interesting. Your father was a vocalist. Your mother was a dancer. Tell us a little bit about your parents, and did they encourage you to pursue music, or did it just happen naturally?
Well, music was around since my mother. I'm sure many people have seen that videotape of Fats Waller, who wrote Ain't Misbehavin', the real beautiful lady sitting on the piano singing it to Fats Waller. Well, that was my mother.
All right.
She and her twin sister were in about 15 of Fats Waller's videotapes, and she danced in the Cotton Club. At the time when Cab Calloway, a band, was working at the Cotton Club. And my father, he was in a group called the Charioteers, which was the number one black singing group in the early 40s, over and above the Ink Spots and the Mills Brothers.
Okay.
And he also, the Charioteers, also procured Frank Sinatra to sing with him on two recordings.
Okay.
And by virtue of them being in show business, I mean, people like Duke Ellington, and in fact, my mother's roommate in the Cotton Club was Billie Holiday. And from my mother tells me, Billie Holiday used to change my diapers. But I don't remember that either. And her best friend in the Cotton Club was Lena Horne. And so Duke Ellington used to come by the house, Dizzy Gillespie. So I was always surrounded by music growing up, like in elementary school.
Okay. Yeah. Now, who were some of your earliest influences on the trumpet? I know you started out with classical training.
Even before the classical training, my mother and Sarah Vaughan, when I was 9 years old, even before that, in the fifth grade, I took a musical aptitude test in the Bronx at the elementary school I went to.
Okay.
And I passed, and so they put me and my best friend at the time, Larry Cass, in a musical class, and they had instruments. And so Larry Cass, my best friend, he played clarinet. So, of course, I wanted to play clarinet, too, like Larry. But they ran out of clarinets. All they had left was the accordion and the violin. And I said, oh, no, no. So my mother took, and Sarah Vaughan took, when I was 9 years old, took me to see Louis Armstrong at the Apollo, because she knew him well, took me backstage, and that was my first experience. Satchmo, Louis Armstrong, on his horn and mouthpiece, taught me how to make a sound. You know, so that was the beginning of that. And my mother's brother, Uncle Louie, he had a trumpet, which he gave me. So I practiced Dylan, took private lessons, and by the time I was 10, I could play Flight with a Bumblebee.
Okay.
And so my mother took me down again to see Louis Armstrong. We went in the back, and Louis Armstrong looked at me and said, hey, little Eddie, you still playing? I said, yeah, man, give me a horn. I snatched his horn and played Flight of the Bumblebee for him. And I remember he screamed and kind of fell halfway off the chair. And as he was getting back in the chair, he said, man, that's some of the baddest stuff I ever heard in my life. Hey, Louise, get me that book of my 10 solos transcribed. And I still have that book.
Okay.
It says he wrote on it, to little Eddie, this is to warm your chops up by. You sound beautiful. Keep playing. Love, Satchmo.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had no idea who this man was. I was just 10 years old, you know. But in retrospect, I look back and say, oh, my God. So that was the beginning of it.
You know, and I bet you, Eddie, you know, with the way things are today, you probably could go on eBay and sell that for several thousand dollars.
Oh, no. I wouldn't sell that. That's priceless.
All right. Well, you know, I also understand that Miles Davis, you know, influenced you in a way.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, I've never heard anything other than Louis Armstrong, jazz, so to speak, because I was studying classical music in elementary school, and then when I got to, at age 14, parents moved to San Francisco, I started studying classical music privately from the lead trumpet player in the San Francisco Symphony. And about the time I was either a sophomore or a junior in high school, my stepfather was a doctor to all jazz. He loved jazz. So he was a doctor to all the greats, you know, Sarah Vaughan, John Coltrane, Miles, Cannonball, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, and all that. So when I came home, you know, a lesson at the conservatory, guess who's in the house? Miles Davis. He's staying the whole week at the house because he's appearing at the Black Hawk.
Okay.
And this is the time when he had John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, Philly Joe Jones, Paul Chambers, and Wynton Kelly.
Wynton Kelly, yeah.
And so Miles, in his car, took just me to the gig the first night, and when the band hit, the light went on in my head, and I said to myself, Eddie, that's what you should do for the rest of your life. I had no idea you could do that with a horn.
Yeah, yeah.
I was mesmerized.
Okay.
And to this day, you know, Miles is my first biggest influence, even though Louis Armstrong, I met him when I was 9, but I was too young and immature. It didn't register.
Yeah. Now, of course, before we came on the air, one of the tunes I played from your new CD was the Moon Train, Woody Shaw's composition.
Oh, yeah.
Was Woody an influence on you, man?
Oh, absolutely. I met Woody when I was in my first year of medical school at Howard University. A mutual friend of ours, Tyrone Washington,
excellent
saxophone player, who eventually played with Woody in Horace Silver's album.
Yeah.
I think the Jody Grind.
Yeah,
and anyway, so I met Woody in 1964. We became immediate friends, and I loved the way Woody played. We used to practice together, and I had been playing the Moon Train since about 1965. I had a little group of my own while in medical school, and so finally for this last date on Smoke Records, I said, Why don't I play one of the tunes of one of my mentors?
Yeah, know? Yeah. Well, you know, Eddie, and it's interesting you mentioned Tyrone Washington because, you know, he's kind of a musician that has kind of been forgotten. But I remember an album that he did for Blue Note called Natural Essence.
Oh, wasn't that something?
Yeah. So what, you know, what happened to Tyrone, man?
Well, Tyrone, Islam, you know, the Muslim faith got into his head, and he became fanatical about it. He said music, in his words, music was a manifestation of the devil.
Okay.
And he didn't want to be in the bandstand and playing music anymore.
Okay. Okay.
I said, Tyrone, please. I speak to him to this day, but he doesn't play anymore.
All right. And I know he also appeared on a couple of recordings by Larry Young as well. So, you know, I always like him, yeah.
Oh, Tyrone was fantastic. I mean, when I was going to medical school, Tyrone was my best friend. And after school, I'd just go over to his house after medical school each day. I go to just watch him practice.
Yeah.
He taught me so much.
Okay.
Physically, yeah.
Now,
great.
Let's talk about the relationship between medicine and music. How did you manage those two pursuits simultaneously?
Well, you know, my stepfather was a doctor. When I first met him when I was 14, when we moved, my mother and I moved to San Francisco, he and I did not get along.
Okay.
And he made a statement to me that he was a doctor, and that was the closest thing to God. And I didn't have the intelligence to be a doctor like him, and I was going to be a bum on the waterfront. Well, he was talking to the wrong person. That just made me mad. And I told him, I said, oh, yeah, watch.
Uh-huh.
So I just went out of my way. I really didn't want to be a doctor, but to prove him wrong, because I didn't like him.
Okay.
So I just went out of my way to study medicine. But I still continued to play the trumpet.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the inspiring thing that made me hunch my back pretty hard just to prove him wrong.
You know, and it's interesting the things that will motivate you, you know.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah, yeah. Now, when did you stop practicing, or have you stopped practicing medicine, man?
Well, I only I got the degree in 68.
Okay.
Did a residency up until 70, 71. In psychiatry, picked psychiatry only because the on-call schedule was once every 45 days instead of every other night.
Yeah.
Well, that afforded me more time to play the trumpet.
All right.
But I didn't start practicing medicine until 1975, until like 1986.
Okay.
For about 11 years, but just general practice at somebody else's office. And they afforded me the luxury of even when I would go get a tour or something, they'd pay me even when I wasn't there.
Okay.
So it was like I had my cake and ate it.
Well, you know, and it's interesting in terms of psychiatry, man. So did musicians try to stay away from you because they were afraid you were going to analyze them, man?
Well, not really, because I would when they come, you know, come on like that, I said, well, don't worry, brother. I got to get off the couch myself. I'm too busy trying to get myself together.
I hear you. Now
let's
talk about it. Once again, I'm talking with trumpeter Eddie Henderson. Let's talk about some of your early experiences and some of the people you've played with. One of the people I want to talk to you about, of course, is Herbie Hancock.
Oh, my God.
And of course, I mentioned that because I actually saw you guys in NYDC at the Lighthouse.
Wasn't that a hell of a group?
In the early 70s. And also, yeah. You know, just recently I talked with Buster Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about his experience, you know, with that group. And he kind of mentioned to me that, you know, in terms of that group, Herbie never told you guys what to play. The music just kind of evolved organically,
yeah.
He said, man.
Yeah. That's the thing. I think Herbie learned that from Miles.
Okay.
Miles, you know, he hires racehorses. And just like, why have a racehorse if you don't let him run?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Herbie never, in the 3.5, well, actually I played with him 5.5 years, because he hired me again for the Gershwin tour for 2 years after the M1DC. But he never told me what to play or how to play. You know, he just let me evolve on my own to find my own voice. And I really love him for that. And, you know, Herbie is really a true genius. Him hiring me out of nowhere was like a fluke accident.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Johnny Coles went on sabbatical, and he needed somebody just for 1 week in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I just happened to be there at the time, and that 1 week turned into the rest of my life.
Well, you know, and that's kind of the same way that it happened with Herbie, right? I mean, Donald Byrd
Absolutely.
Needed somebody to sit in for
same
Duke.
Thing. Same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Same.
Well, it, you know, yeah. and it's interesting that you said, you know, Herbie didn't tell you guys what to play, that it just kind of evolved organically, because when you listen to it, and at that time, it seemed like everything was planned out, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like that.
Yeah.
But I think that's just, I think Herbie learned in picking musicians, that he had the astute awareness, just like Miles Davis. You know, some people play ahead of the beat and behind the beat. You know, Miles Davis had the uncanny ability to know how things were going to sound in terms of musical chemistry before they played together.
Yeah,
You know, it's an intangible awareness. And I think Herbie picked the musicians in his group with that kind of invisible awareness. And it was about, like, the chemistry. It was just like John Coltrane's quartet.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that happens every now and then.
Yeah. And Buster was, and I remember, too, you know, in terms of you guys and what I found and what I thought was really cool at that time, of course, I was a teenager at that time,
mm-hmm.
is that you guys had, you know, your African names.
Yeah.
And Buster was very surprised when I called him M. Chazazi. He didn't, you know, he said, what, you know me by that? And I said, you know, I remember that. And I remember your name was Maganga, right?
M. Ganga.
And I talked about Billy Hart, who was Jabali. And, you know,
Bobby was Inner Strength. Yeah,
yeah. And so he said that you guys still kind of keep in touch.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I call Herbie. I call Buster. I see Jabali practically every week because he's both he and I are visiting teachers at Oberlin Conservatory of Music.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now another person I want to talk to you about that you played with for a long time, of course, is Billy Harper. And of course, you know, I think, you know, you were in probably one of his best bands. And one of the things I always find interesting about Billy Harper, of course, those who know his music know that he's also an outstanding composer, is that many of his tunes have these long intros, man. I mean, what was that like?
Very dramatic. Very dramatic. He's a very dramatic guy.
Yeah.
with his capes and stuff. and just personally, his voice, you know, is very unique. His speaking voice, his presentation musically, got his own style musically, and every stroke of his pen is almost like a Billy Harper classic.
Yeah, it is, man. And so what is it like playing those intros? Those intros are almost 2 or 3 minutes long themselves, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love it. You know, Billy Harper, Dr. Chemistry between Billy and I, it's kind of unique. We just kind of melt into each other, you know. I when I play with him, I just look at him, and when he takes a breath, you know, and we both breathe together.
Yeah.
So it almost sounds like one thing as opposed to two instruments.
Yeah.
You know, playing.
Yeah, and because like I said, I think that group that you were in with him, that was, you know, that was one of the best groups, I think, you know, around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
That was a powerful band.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Billy's in that group, the Cookers.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you about the Cookers a little bit later.
Yeah.
But another musician I wanted to ask you about is Kenny Barron. Of course, he's on your new CD, but you were part of his quintet in the 90s. And you know, you played with him a lot, right?
I played with Kenny when I first moved back to New York for about 6 years.
Okay.
With John Stubblefield. David Williams. First it was Cecil McBee on bass, then it was David Williams, Victor Lewis on drums, and John Stubblefield on tenor saxophone. That was a wonderful group.
I
loved that group.
Yeah.
For about 6 years. And just recently I played with Kenny out at SF Jazz in San Francisco. Just did one night featuring Kenny Barron's music.
Okay.
And it was a duo, Kenny and myself. Then he also did a duo with Regina Carter on violin, then a duo with Terry Lynn Carrington, drummer, and all in just 30 minutes apiece, each duo. Then we all played the last tune together for an encore.
Okay.
Well, Kenny Barron, he's a grandmaster.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, with all the foundation he has playing with Dizzy Gillespie for 10 years, I mean, he's a consummate professional.
Okay. Now, another musician I wanted to talk to you about, and this is, you know, also interesting because, as I said, you know, our first interview was 23 years ago, but in that time, you know, of course, a lot of things have happened to you. But one of the musicians that I wanted to talk to you about, of course, has passed away since then, and that's Grover Washington Jr.
Oh, my God. Grover was lovely, and he was, I had him on one of my records.
Yeah.
And his solo was just immaculate. And I met Grover out in San Francisco at the Keystone Corner. We played a gig, and we just felt an affinity towards each other's playing. So when I did my record, you know, Todd Barton,
yeah,
owner of the Keystone, he produced the record. So we both recommended have Grover play a few tunes on it. And it was just like the chemistry again was just unique. And then Grover had me play on his record, All My Tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
With Hank Jones on piano, and oh, he was loved. What a lovely person, and what a tragedy that he passed, because he was such a clean-cut guy.
Yeah, but, yeah.
And nobody stays here forever.
And of course, you know, there's never, I guess, a good time to pass, but he certainly passed way before his time, you know?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, okay. And of course, the recording you're talking about in terms of your recording, Inspiration, he was on that one.
Oh, yeah, that's the one.
And both of you guys were on that tribute to Lee Morgan recording, which I thought was outstanding.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I loved Grover.
All right. Now, another musician I wanted to talk to you about, Eddie, that you've played with, you know, quite a bit, is Benny Golson. Now, I talked with pianist Mike LaDon here on the show before, and we talked about Benny Golson. What's your impressions about Benny Golson, man?
Oh, well, Benny Golson, off the bandstand, just, you know, without the saxophone in his mind, he's a consummate gentleman. And on the bandstand, you know, musically, I mean, I've been looking up to Benny since I first started playing.
Yeah.
Him was playing with the Jazz Messengers and his tune "Moaning."
Yeah.
I heard, you know, with Lee Morgan playing with Art Blakey. You know, he's one of my heroes.
Okay.
And it was such an honor for him to ask. I think I've done 3 albums with him.
Yeah, I think you did. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I talked with Mike LaDon, because one of the things I mentioned to him or asked him about, of course, was Benny Golson's sound, and he said, man, Benny Golson might use the thickest reed of any saxophone player he ever saw, man.
Yeah, well, I tried to go out of my way to blend with his sound.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just really an inspiration for me just standing next to him, you know, touching souls through the medium of our individual sounds,
yeah,
trying to make it one.
Okay.
Like I heard him do with Lee Morgan and everybody else.
Okay. Now, we mentioned the Cookers, and of course, that's a group that you have been a part of, I guess, since its inception.
Yes.
And it features, you know, once again, Billy Harper, George Cable, Cecil McBee, Billy Hart, and now Donald Harrison. And so, you know, and I went online and saw that you guys, the Cookers, you guys are going to be touring and performing throughout 2019. But I also saw on there that Stephen Scott is going to be sitting in for George Cables beginning in February. How is George Cables, man? Is he doing okay?
George Cables is fine. You know, he had an amputation of his leg.
Okay.
But now he's got a prosthesis. And our first gig is in Australia, but I think George had a prior commitment.
Okay.
So that's the only reason he's not going, but George is still in the group.
Okay.
You know, so Stephen Scott's just filling in for him.
Okay, and because I was wondering, I heard he had been, you know, I didn't know, you know, what had happened to him, but I kind of heard that he was having some health problems, but I didn't know he had lost a leg.
Yeah, he lost a leg, I think, at the knee. I think it was his left one, but he's back mobile again, playing his
what off. Yeah, I know, yeah. So he had diabetes, man?
He's had so many problems.
Yeah.
He had a kidney transplant, a liver transplant, now the amputation. But he's still playing like his life depends on it.
Okay.
You know, so he's well.
And he's another musician that I've interviewed here on the show, and I really enjoy talking with him. He was just...
Oh, he's lovely.
Yeah, he really was, man. Now, let's talk about your latest recordings. As I said, your latest recordings are on Smoke Sessions, your first recording for that label, Collective Portrait, featured Gary Bartz and George Cables.
Right.
Your most recent one, your new one, is Be Cool, and it includes compositions by your wife and your daughter.
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit about those compositions.
The title of the album, Be Cool, is the name of the song my wife wrote.
Okay.
And it more or less exemplifies one little cute thing I tell everybody. She wrote it for me, saying, okay, Eddie, now when you go to the gig, be cool. And my daughter, you know, she's very musically inclined.
Yeah. Yeah.
She graduated from Berklee School of Music, then got her master's in film orchestration from University of Miami. Now she's the head of the music department at Oakland High School of Performing Arts and chairman of the vocal department there. And she's a wonderful writer, wonderful pianist. Well, she wrote that tune, Night Ride, specifically for this date.
Okay.
And, you know, that mysterious tune.
Night Ride. And in fact, I was going to ask you about that, but we'll come back to that. So, and her name is Kava Menzies, right?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And
Menzies because her mother remarried again and changed her name.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. But
so
it was Kava Henderson initially.
Okay, so in terms of this recording, Be Cool, you know, we mentioned, of course, Kenny Barron is on there. Also, Donald Harrison, who, of course, performs with you in the Cookers. But tell me a little bit about ECDC, man. I see him on a lot of recordings, but I don't know much about him, but I think he's an outstanding bassist.
About which one?
ECDC.
Oh, Essiet?
Yeah.
I first met Essiet or saw him when he was with his years. He played with Art Blakey.
Okay.
And then Essiet's wife, Sylvia Cuenca, a drummer, they hired me many times to do tours out on the West Coast. And he's very fantastic, very unique, and very experienced bass player that I've come to love as one of my favorites. And he and Mike Clark, they play a lot of gigs together.
Okay.
So just the hookup between the drums and the bass is like magic.
Okay.
And
yeah.
With Kenny Barron, you know, putting ice in the cake, can't go wrong.
Well, you know, when I talked with Buster, he said if the bass and the drummer are not kicking, the band is not going to be kicking. He said.
Yeah, exactly. The bass and the drums have to be seamless, or else everything will fall through the hole.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's talk about some of the tunes on this recording. Of course, we talked about Moon Train. Of course, Toys is Herbie Hancock's tune. Did you ever play that with Herbie?
What, Toys?
Toys, yeah.
Oh, well, we played that from the time I joined the M1DC group to the end.
Okay, okay. Now
3 years, and it just was like a brainstorm. I was trying to think of compositions. I said, well, let me play Toys with this new band.
Yeah,
and it came out great.
Okay, now and you know that in fact that's one of my favorite compositions by Herbie.
Oh, great!
And it's
great.
One that you don't hear a lot of people play.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, they always play Maiden Voyage or something like that, but they don't play Toys, you know.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Tell me about Fran Dance, man.
Well, Fran Dance really touched my musical heartstrings way back when I was in high school, when Miles Davis was staying at the house, when he had Hank Mobley, Wynton Kelly, Jimmy Cobb, and Paul Chambers in the band. I'd go every night, you know, to see Miles when I was a teenager, and he would always play Fran Dance every night, and it was, you know, dedicated to his wife Frances, who was also staying at the house. That beautiful lady.
She was a beautiful woman.
And so I always loved that tune. I said, well, let me play this, some of the tunes that I love that not many people play.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Okay, now another tune on the recording that I wanted to ask you about was Naima, of course, the John Coltrane tune.
Oh,
it's a very interesting arrangement of that tune. Who did that arrangement, man?
Well, I more or less suggested rather than because I recorded it once before, almost like Miles did on Sketches of Spain, just with a drum cadence in the back.
Yeah.
But then I said, why don't we do something different and do it in 3/4, 6/8. Sort of like My Favorite Things, kind of thing, you know, and it takes on a completely different.
It does,
you know, contour.
Yeah, I've never heard it played that way before.
Yeah.
Okay, now we also mentioned, Eddie, that of course you're involved in jazz education. Mm-hmm. You know, you've taught at Juilliard, and you're a visiting professor now at Oberlin. Has you know, jazz education, and I ask a lot of musicians this question, particularly those involved in jazz education, has it become too codified, you think? I mean, can jazz education provide the kind of experience that used to come from mentoring?
Yeah, well I don't think anything can replace mentoring and actual on-the-job training, but all knowledge enhances all gifts. You know, but can you imagine when Charlie Parker was coming up and John Coltrane, they did not have the advantage of all these computers and all the wealth of knowledge at the hand. Just push a button, and you can see all the people in history, solos and stuff. It's good, but, you know, it doesn't replace the actual mentoring and getting on the bandstand and the live experience. Of the art form.
What in your opinion then would be the purpose of jazz education in terms of these formal programs? Is it to produce jazz musicians, or is it just to produce good musicians?
That's a hard question. You know, because a lot of people, you've heard people say jazz is dead. From my experience, I don't see that at all, because you see all these applicants for these jazz schools, not all around the country, but all around the world. They have jazz school. People want to play jazz. But the only sad thing about this is that, you know, a lot of these people, they get their degree in jazz studies and or performance, jazz performance, get a degree in it. And after they finish school, now what? There's not that much outlet to work unless you have a big name. You know, and that's the dichotomy and the only drawback from going to school and getting an education.
I mean, because
you're well qualified, but if there's no outlet,
because you got, you know, you guys are producing all these, you know, musicians, but there's nowhere for them to play.
Unless they have a big name. Even when you have a big name, it's still rough.
Well, I would think that it, you know, at least from the musicians' side, you know, this proliferation of jazz education programs is a good thing. I mean, I remember talking with Jimmy Heath, and he said, "Man, you know, until I got that teaching gig, I didn't have insurance or anything like that."
Well, that's the wonderful thing. Even if I don't have a gig, I'm teaching, and I'm keeping the horn in my mouth. And it keeps, while I'm teaching, it keeps my mind active too, and so I don't lose what I already have musically.
And once again, I'm talking with trumpeter Eddie Henderson, and really, Eddie, I can't believe that 30 minutes have gone by already.
Oh, me too.
You know, but
when you're having fun.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm really enjoying this, man. But tell me a little bit about some of your future plans. I mean, you know, what's in the future for Eddie Henderson? Are you working on a new CD already,
I'm not working on a new one at present. Okay. I was just thinking about that within this last week. It's ironic you asked that. But right now, you know, I'm just letting things settle and see how this CD does, and it's done very well. So I'm keep doing as I've done in the past, just keep polishing the mirror and honing my craft, and just hope for the best. Just hope things work out. I've been fortunate up to this point in my life, so I'm not gonna, you know, try to force anything. Everything has, you know, that word serendipity. I don't know whether it's called luck or what. But I've been very fortunate up to this point. So I'm gonna just let the pieces, the pieces just fall in as they may.
Okay. Now let me just go back for a minute, Eddie. And you know, in the 70s, as of course many jazz musicians did, you dabbled in fusion. Do you ever play any of that, you know, today?
Well, the last time I did that, the first group that got me out, I mean, record that got me out there was on Blue Note called Sunburst.
Yeah, I remember that.
With Alphonse Johnson and George Duke. Well, all those tunes are on there. There's a group in England called Mr. Gone who plays all the recordings on that tune. And the subsequent album after that, Mahal, on Blue Note Records, where I was playing Wah Wah, Echo Plex, and Faye Shifter, they play all the tunes exactly like the record.
Okay.
I mean, solos and everything. So they had me come over twice and do a tour of Scandinavia and England with them, and it's unbelievable. It was just, but because I had forgotten the tune, but they sent me the music. It got me Echoplex and Wawa. And I had fun.
Well, you know, and it's interesting you say that, Eddie, because, you know, whenever anybody talks about NYDC, they always talk about that as sort of being a fusion band. But, you know, initially, you guys weren't using any kind of electronic instruments.
The only person who was using electronics was Herbie.
Yeah.
But that was an acoustic band.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Except for the last record that we did, the first VSOP, Julian Priester and myself had Echoplexes and Wah-Wahs, and
Okay. Now, in fact, mentioning Julian Priester, what is he doing, man?
Well, he's living out in Seattle. He retired from a teaching job at Cornish Institute. In fact, we talked about a week ago, and he's just talking about moving back to New York because he's frustrated. There's no outlet, for his creative part of his being in terms of playing, being a player out there.
He's a great trombone player. I don't think he gets mentioned much when they talk about great trombone players, but he's a great trombone player, man.
Oh, he played with Duke Ellington, Max Roach, Art Blakey, played with everybody.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned George Duke, man. Of course, that's another guy who kind of passed away way too early.
Yeah.
Tell me about a little bit about George Duke, man.
Well, I met George Duke way back when I was going to college.
Okay.
Before medical school. This is like early 60s when I first started playing. Well, he was living around San Francisco, just playing the local clubs around there. Then he became super famous, and the producer acquired him on that record Sunburst, my first record on Blue Note, and he's grandmaster.
Okay.
He really was.
Now, and so, once again, I've been talking with Trumper Eddie Henderson. We've been talking about his life and his latest CD, Be Cool. And Eddie, of course, also, you were on a recent recording by drummer McClenty Hunter, which I liked a lot.
Yes.
You and Donald Harrison were on there. Tell me a little bit about McClenty. He seemed like one of the younger guys who kind of, you know, is headed in the right direction, man.
Oh, yes. Well, he studied, the tradition of the music, and it was just seamless playing with him, He's one of the younger guys, but he's mature in his musical concepts, and he knows the evolution of the music. So I don't look at him as being young.
Yeah.
I mean, he's certainly well qualified.
Okay. Now, and we're going to leave, Eddie, and I really do appreciate you taking time out of your schedule.
Oh, my pleasure, brother.
And as I said, I can't believe we've been talking for over 30 minutes.
Me too.
It doesn't seem like it, but... I want to leave with something from your new CD, Be Cool, and that's the tune by your daughter, Kava Menzies. Tell me a little bit about that tune, Night Ride, man. I really like that.
Okay, buddy.
All right. Once again, that's Eddie Henderson here on Return to the Source. It's music from his latest CD, Be Cool, the composition called Night Ride.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome to Return to the Source on WJAB from the campus of Alabama A&M University, 90.9.
You're listening to music by trumpeter Eddie Henderson from his latest recording called Be Cool. In fact, be my first caller here, 256-372-5861. You can win a copy of the CD you're listening to right now, Eddie Henderson's Be Cool. And we'd like to congratulate Mr. Rodney Jatenet. I believe I'm saying that right. Jatenet, he won himself a copy of the CD you're listening to right now. It's Eddie Henderson's CD called Be Cool. You're listening to Return to the Source here at 90.9 FM. Thank you. listening to trumpeter Eddie Henderson from his latest release on Smoke Sessions Records called Be Cool, a tune written by his daughter, Kava Menzies. It's called Night Ride, and it features Donald Harrison on the alto sax, Kenny Barron on piano, Essiet on bass, and Mike Clark on the drums. You're listening to Return to the Source here at 90.9 FM. Keep your dial here. Coming up, holiday cheer from your friends at WJAB. But first, this message.
Kwanzaa is a unique African-American celebration with focus on the traditional African values of family, community, responsibility, commerce, and self-improvement. Kwanzaa means first fruits of the harvest in the African language Kiswahili. It was founded in 1966 by Dr. Malana Karenga. Kwanzaa is based on the Nguzo Saba, seven guiding principles, one for each day of the observance, and is celebrated from December 26th to January 1st. To learn about the Kwanzaa principles, listen as WJAB brings them to you each day starting December 26th.
I'm Yvonne Artis, Executive Secretary for Electronic Media Communications, wishing you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Welcome to Return to the Source on WJAB from the campus of Alabama A&M University, 90.9.
Place to go. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I hate going out in the storm. But if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Thank you. goodnight. I hate going out in the storm, but if you really hold me tight, Mother will help me warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
You better watch out. You better not cry. Better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list and checking it twice. Gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake. Better watch out. Better not cry. Better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Claus is coming to town. Ooh, shooby-dooby, ooh, 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 shooby-dooby, oh. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be bad for goodness sake. Say it out, need it. Watch out. Better not cry. Better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town.
yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are as in olden golden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years we all will be together, if the fates allow. Hang a shining star upon the highest bough. Oh, and have yourself a merry little Christmas now. Little Christmas, let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas, make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years we all will be together, if the fates allow. Hang a shining star upon the highest bough, and have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
That was music from vocalist Mary Stallings from the recording Max Jazz Holiday. We heard her performing the tune Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Before that, we heard Diana Krall with the tune Santa Claus is Coming to Town. In fact, featured her with the Ray Brown Trio from their recording Christmas Songs with the Ray Brown Trio. That was Jeff Keezer on piano, Gregory Hutchinson on the drums. We started out the set with music from the late vocalist Betty Carter from the recording called Jazz for Joy on Verve Records. And of course, we heard her performing the tune Let It Snow, featuring the late trumpeter Roy Hargrove as well. You're listening to Return to the Source. Keep your dial here at 90.9 FM. We'll be back with new music from pianist David Hazeltine. But first, these messages.